This land, it's all mine. This calling bell, this forge bell, this dark bell, this the knife bell, this calling, this burden, this falling, the world turning. This what I thought I knew, this what I thought was true, this I understood, this in the deep wood, this ah, there I stood, a child so fair. This on a certain square, this down the dirty stairs, this to see the table set, this with golden chairs, this ah, to follow, 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 follow them.
I'm Rabia Yemen for The Digital Divide. Today I'm joined by Tom Standage. He's the author of Writing on the Wall, Social Media, the First 2,000 Years. Tom Standage has been the editor of the Technology Quarterly and is the digital editor at The Economist and editor-in-chief of the magazine's website, economist.com. His previous five books include An Edible History of Humanity, A History of the World in Six Glasses, and the Victorian Internet. He holds a degree in engineering and computer science from Oxford University and says he is the least musical member of a musical family. He lives in London with his wife and children. Welcome, Tom Standage.
Hello, it's good to be here.
So how unmusical are you? Wait a minute. Aren't you in a band?
Yeah, I'm a drummer. So it's that old joke about four musicians and a drummer. So the other members of my immediate family are all musicians for a living. And I do this kind of journalism, writing books, lark. And then I play drums on the side. So it's the four musicians and a drummer.
You were kind of drumming as soon as you entered the studio.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, when there's a microphone picking things up and you tap different parts of the table, you get different sounds. I'm just inclined to start playing drum beats, I'm afraid.
Today we're going to be talking about your new book, obviously, Writing on the Wall, and you're in town to read at Powell's tonight. And when this airs, that will have already occurred. But is it correct to say that the premise of this book is that social networks are as old as papyrus?
Yes, pretty much. In fact, social networks are older. I mean, social networks, you know, go back to before we were even humans. You know, animals have social networks. So I'm talking about social media, which is the ability to exchange information along social networks with people who aren't physically present. And to do that, you need to be able to read and write. And so you need a fair amount of literacy, and you also need it to be cheap to copy and deliver information. And today, we can do all this with the internet. We can connect up with people who are a long way away. And digital technology means that copying and delivering information is very cheap. But if you look in history, this has happened before. And in fact, the earliest example that I can find is the late Roman Republic. And the reason that it's possible to do social media if you're a Roman is that there was a moderate amount of literacy among both men and women in the Roman period, but also that they had slaves to do the copying and the delivery of the stuff. So slaves were like the Roman broadband. And so you see this, that the members of the Roman elite start exchanging information with each other using messengers and scribes to actually do the legwork. It looks very much like a modern social media environment.
Would you compare the advent of the printing press and the internet as being equally profound?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, both of them massively expand the access to and the power of media. So you start off with, you know, written forms of media, and then you can print, and that means you can reach a lot more people a lot more quickly. But at the same time, you need to have be in a privileged position of having people print your stuff. But we do get social media environments that emerge with the printing press, and the example I look at in my book, one of the examples is Martin Luther, and he uses printed pamphlets to spread his message. message that, you know, the Catholic Church has got it wrong on indulgences, and this leads to the Reformation. And what happens there is that he writes a pamphlet and he gives it to the printer in his village, who, and there's no money changing hands here. The printer just knows there's so much interest in what Luther has to say, he can print 1,000 copies and people will buy them. And then people take those copies to other towns, and the printers there realize, you know, there's money to be made here. So they reprint it, and it gets reprinted and reprinted and reprinted, and soon you've got essentially millions of pamphlets whizzing around Europe, spreading Luther's message. And all he's really had to do is sit there and give them to the local printer and let everything spread on its own. So this idea that the audience chooses what's important and amplifies it is, you know, very much the way a social media system works. You haven't got money changing hands with the author. You've got people sort of trying to make money along the way. But yes, it's very much a sort of open peer-to-peer system, unlike what comes later, where you have radio and TV and mass circulation newspapers, and they all involve expensive pieces of technology that allow you to reach a large number of people very efficiently. But not everyone can afford them. We can't all have radio stations. So the result is that access to those newer forms of media ends up concentrated in the hands of a very small group, and so that's much less democratic. It's one way, it's not conversational, and so on. And what we've seen with social media in the past decade is that the internet has made it possible for two-way forms of media to compete with broadcast. And so my argument in the book is that we're kind of going back to the pre-industrial way that media worked. It used to be conversational, two-way, and social. So instead of this social media thing we're doing now being totally new, it's actually a reversion to the way things were for most of history.
When Martin Luther's booklets were printed, only literate people could read them. So can you really make that comparison when the majority of people were literate and limited by geography and exchanging information by word of mouth?
Well, clearly, over time, social media systems have been accessible to more people. And we are on the cusp now of a situation where anyone in the world who wants to publish will be able to do so. You know, internet access is spreading very quickly in the developing world. And I think within 20 years, you know, universal internet access is probably within reach. But yes, what the interesting thing about Luther is that many of Luther's own pamphlets and those of his rivals and his contemporaries actually say, you know, it's your duty to read this out to people who are illiterate so they can access this information as well. And so you get this, that Luther's pamphlets were discussed in taverns and read out in churches, and you get entire, you know, guilds or workplaces full of people converting to his point of view, which shows you that this was being distributed by word of mouth in the workplace as well. So actually, you know, there are ways that you can bring in people who don't have direct access to the technology of the day.
In the book, I like your chart of Martin Luther's traffic statistics. The number of editions of his pamphlets printed each year in German and Latin. That's amusing, but is it legitimate to compare outward distribution of a printed booklet with inward traffic to web content?
Yeah, I think it is, because if you look at what is happening when we look at our traffic stats on a blog, or we look at how many likes or retweets we're getting, those are proxies for the extent to which people are interested in what we're, you know, that's why we are looking at those numbers, because we want to see how much impact what we're saying is having. And what those numbers do for Martin Luther, and I've plotted them as a chart that looks like a sort of omniture, or, you know, it looks like a modern website traffic graph.
Analytics.
Exactly, web analytics. So, but you know, they are actually serving the same function, because the number of times that printers chose to reprint a particular pamphlet of Luther's was a very good measure of how much demand for it there was. They would only reprint 1,000 copies of his pamphlet if they were pretty sure people were going to want it. So I think that is a legitimate way to measure the impact of what he was doing and the extent to which people were interested in it.
Let's go back to a statement you made just a few minutes ago, where you said anybody can be a publisher now. And that's true. And, you know, we do radio here at KBOO. And even though more and more people say that they're not listening to radio, radio is still more exclusive than the internet, you know, because there's only so many slices a day, you know, in terms of time slots. So if anybody can be a publisher, does that cheapen or trivialize information?
Well, this again is a timeless complaint that when you broaden access to publishing, that the wrong people will publish the wrong sorts of things, and that we won't approve of them. And this goes, you know,
memes.
Yeah, well, but also this exact complaint was made by Luther's contemporary Erasmus. So just as Luther is spreading pamphlets around Europe saying, you know, the Pope's got it wrong, Erasmus says the trouble with all these pamphlets, you know, they're written in this really easy to read German vernacular instead of in Latin. And this means that people aren't reading the classics anymore. So he thinks this is bad. And it's the same way that people say, oh, you know, children these days, they don't read books because they're just watching YouTube. You know, the idea is that the old media was good and was, you know, we should all have spent all our time reading that. But actually, if you look at novels, when novels appeared in the 1750s, they were criticized because people were reading novels. They were sitting inside, and the sofa, in fact, showed up around the same time. So people were sitting inside. They were drifting off into another world reading this book when they should have been talking to their friends. And then that became sort of acceptable, and novels were good.
Or their priests.
Yeah, well, or whatever. But they weren't dealing with people face to face. So it's the same sort of criticism we get of video games now, that, you know, people are playing video games when they should be, you know, playing in the woods with their friends or whatever. So these all turn out to be timeless criticisms, that the old ways of doing things were okay, and then the new ones are unacceptable. And then the new ways of doing things become acceptable, and then the even newer things are the unacceptable things. So this is just a kind of repeating trope in the history of media, that new media is always terrible and particularly bad for children and is going to, you know, undermine their mental development, whereas the old media was fine. And, you know, this can't be true. It can't be true over and over again. And so I think we need some sort of historical perspective on all of these debates. And that's what I'm trying to provide in the book, that many of the criticisms made about social media today have arisen in the past.
That's the most legitimate argument I've ever heard.
Well, I've been collecting these examples of, of these moral panics you get around media for many years, and you name it. I mean, you know, comic books were supposed to turn you into drug dealers, and rock and roll was supposed to turn you into a Satanist, and, you know, people worried about video games turning you into mass murderers. But if you look at what's actually happened since video games became ubiquitous, you know, levels of violent crime have actually gone down. So you just get this over and over again, and you get this idea that there's a very nice quote about this from Douglas Adams, a science fiction writer, who said that anything that was existed before you were born has always existed and is great. Anything that's invented before you're 35 is awesome and must be adopted, and anything that's invented after you're 35 is terrible and must be banned. And this is what this really reflects is people's unwillingness to go along with new things after a certain age, and then they criticize it. And the usual way they kind of get people worked up about it is they say this is bad for the children. And we see this now with social media, but we saw this with coffee houses in the 1670s, and we saw it with pamphlets in the 1530s. We saw it with waltzing, and we see it with, you know, with radio, and it just happens with every form of media, it would seem.
Waltzing, watch out for people who waltz.
Yes, that's right. Well, waltzing led to promiscuity. The Victorians thought waltzing was, well, actually it was a bit earlier than the Victorians, but they thought it was terrible. All that sort of throwing yourselves around would be bad for your brain, and it would lead to promiscuity, and, you know, so.
Were they wrong?
Well, we don't seem to have.
Invent it, right?
No, exactly. I mean, but the point is, something that we regard as very sort of straight-laced and respectable was regarded as absolutely outrageous at the beginning of the 19th century. So this just, I think, tells you this is a recurring thing.
How fickle we are is what it tells me.
Yeah, possibly.
Well, actually, I'm really glad that's a great segue to a section of your book that I found really amusing. And that was in regard to the coffee houses of 1673. And I just wanted to read the short passage, unless you'd like to read it, although it's not quite as organized as I'd like it to be. Would you like to do that?
Yeah, sure, show me.
Okay. So I think...
Is it the quotes about
just
people?
Just right here. There's two separate quotes. There's this section and that section.
Oh, okay, cool.
We're with Tom Standage today on The Digital Divide. I'm your host, Robbie Yeaman, and I was going to read a little quote from the book.
Yeah, so it seems appropriate, actually, given that this is such a coffee-loving part of the world, but this is one of my favourite examples. So coffee houses became very popular in the late 1600s, in London in particular, and people complained that they were sort of too addictive, that people were going to them and just sharing media with their friends and networking and exchanging gossip.
Ironic.
Exactly. It was terrible. And so there was a pamphlet called The Grand Concern of England Explained in 1673 that was sort of outlined the problem with coffee houses, for which you can read social media. So it it said that coffeehouses had done great mischiefs to the nation and undone many of the king's subjects, for they, being great enemies to diligence and industry, have been the ruin of many serious and hopeful young gentlemen and tradesmen, who before frequenting these places were diligent students or shopkeepers, extraordinary husbands of their time as well as money, and now they have gone to these coffeehouses, where, meeting friends, they have sat talking 3 or 4 hours, after which a fresh acquaintance appearing, and so one after another all day long, hath begotten fresh discourse. So the idea is that they were going into the coffee houses and sort of in the same way you sort of go into a trance when you go on Twitter, maybe you don't notice the time passing, and then before you realize it, you know, hours have gone past. And and there were many other complaints about this that coffee houses
never happened.
No, there you go. There were complaints that coffee houses were distracting the students of Oxford and Cambridge University from their studies, and this was going to sort of lead to the decline of Britain as a nation, because you know, all of our smartest people were being led astray by coffee houses. But actually, if you look at what happened, and this is the great, you know, lesson for us, I think, today, coffee houses were amazingly fertile crucibles of innovation, because they allowed people and ideas who would otherwise not have encountered each other to mix. And this is because coffee houses had this sort of egalitarian ethos. As one contemporary said, gentleman's mechanic, lord and scoundrel mix, and all are of a piece. So the idea was that you would ignore distinctions of social class, and you would just talk to anyone who was in the coffee house. And so this meant that they were an amazing place for new ideas to emerge. And we get things like the scientific revolution coming out of coffee houses, the Royal Society, Isaac Newton, and the theory of gravitation. He writes his book, Principia Mathematica, to settle a coffee house argument about the theory of gravitation. So it comes out of coffee house arguments. And similarly, we get things like the London Stock Exchange, originally a coffee house. Lloyd's of London, the first marine insurer, originally a coffee house. So there's an amazing amount of innovation happens. And so what looked like time wasting was, in fact, very fertile mixing of ideas. And I think the same thing is happening on social platforms today on the internet, that you know, to old people they look like social not working rather than social networking. But actually, there's some really important stuff going on there.
I love that. Let's talk about, you know, human communication just for a minute. And a question that I've posed to other guests on this show when, you know, the topic was relevant. And that is, if we go back, I have to keep pushing it back farther every year. You know, if we go back, let's say 40 years.
Mm.
Well, no, let's not go that far. So let's go back, say, 30 years.
Mm.
And really the advent of when cell phones were start, or portable phones, car phones, whatever those things were starting to kind of like evolve. And of course, historically, since the advent of the telephone, which was the main means of communication, that's really in the domain of women being the communicators. And men predominantly use the phone when it first arrived. Let's say the first 40, 50 years of the telephone, you know, men, it was a tool that had to do with business.
Well, this is what always happens with new technology, is that business can afford them first, and that tended to mean that men got to use them first, and then later on they spread into the home and then became, you know, more widely available to the rest of society. But that certainly happened with the telegraph and with the telephone.
That's right. But it was really adopted in terms of using it just as a social tool. It was really in the realm of women. And then as cell phones became more common and smartphones and then the internet, now we have a situation where both men and women are communicating for social reasons and not one for social reasons and one for practical utilitarian reasons. So now more people are actually communicating than ever before in the history of people to each other. And, you know, it doesn't have to be profound or important, obviously, but they are. And I'm just wondering, you know, because I don't know if this is right, but I would like to imagine that the more that we as humans use language, that the more evolved we would become. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, it's often said that, you know, people don't write anymore, and you get the modern version. The modern criticism is, and there was actually a professor at Cambridge University who was saying this earlier this year, that, you know, young people these days, they can't write essays, they can't think in anything longer than a tweet or a text message. And it's this classic children, you know, it's all going to the dogs because of technology argument. But actually, if you look at what's happening, Things like Twitter and Facebook and other platforms and Tumblr mean that more people are writing more stuff than ever before. More people are, it's like, you know, diaries. We're all keeping these diaries on the internet, in effect. And so the extent to which people are writing down what they're doing is absolutely unprecedented. Right. And I think that's a good thing. And yes, we're all communicating with each other. And we can communicate with each other in this very lightweight way that, you know, I don't have to interrupt you by ringing you up. And we don't have to both be engaged in the communication at the same time. We can do it in a much more asynchronous less intrusive way, and I think that's a great thing. So I'm a big fan of all this. I'm not sure there's a kind of you know, historically there have been issues that men have had access to things because they've been in the workplace. But actually, if you look at what happened with telegraphy, telegraphy was considered a suitable job for women because it wasn't too strenuous. And when there weren't too many messages to send and receive, they could do some knitting. So this is an amazingly patronizing view, but it turned out that women could use telegraph equipment just as well as men. And you get the first examples of online romances in the sort of 1840s, 1850s, 1860s. And what was very funny is that the telegraph companies segregated the women operators and they put them on a different floor in the telegraph offices so they wouldn't mix with the men and it would all be above board and appropriate. But of course
they don't want those male telegraph operators to become excited.
Well, but this is the thing, that of course the women operators were in direct contact with the men over the wires, and so you get the first examples of sort of online romances, but also of mistaken identity, of, you know, men pretending to be women or women pretending to be men, or telegraph operators becoming friends without realizing the gender of the other person, and all of these sorts of things that we think are very modern and internet related. Actually, there are lots of examples of this from the mid-1800s. So these are sort of, again, timeless things that tend to emerge around communication technology. And we sort of assume that today in the internet era, we're the first people to ever have to grapple with these issues. And what I always try to do in my writing is say, no, look, there's a historical perspective here. We can learn, because many of the issues and the questions and the debates we have about technology today have arisen before.
How has modern social media disrupted mass media corporations?
Well, clearly it's the first time that it's possible for people who don't have access to the big expensive technologies of, you know, printing presses and radio broadcasting and that sort of thing. They can actually compete with mass media for the first time. And we see this, you know, every few days, it seems, there is something that goes viral on the internet, and it's, you know, it's not because some corporation has decided it's important and we should all pay attention to it. Whether it's Gangnam Style or the woman who recently, you know, quit her job and she made that video where she danced around the office, and, you know, millions of people saw that. And what happens is that the modern social media allows the audience to decide what's important and amplify it, and then the mass media picks up on that after the event and says, oh, look, and then it ends up on TV and so on. So I think we're in an interesting time, because the mass media essentially was so powerful and so efficient that it overshadowed the social way of doing things that went before. And people were still exchanging stuff socially. You know, we were still writing letters and sending postcards and making mixtapes. And these are all forms of social media. But where most people got most of their information from was from mass media. So, you know, people would read the newspapers and watch TV and that sort of thing. If you look at many young people now are not reading newspapers at all. They're hardly watching any TV. They're just watching, you know, my children, they watch YouTube and they go on Tumblr. They do not watch TV. They don't really understand what live TV is. They just think that you can make stuff appear on the screen and I want this now. And, you know, so the balance has really shifted, that they are no longer getting most of their media diet from mass media. And so we are, for mass media companies, and, you know, I work for one, obviously, we are in this very interesting situation where we are all trying to figure out what the hybrid of mass media and social looks like. And how do we as mass media companies take advantage of social? And how do people who are using social get their message into mass media to amplify it? So we're in a really interesting, fascinating time, because there is this hybrid emerging. And we've gone from a period that it turns out was a historical anomaly where mass media dominated. And we really have come to the end of that. And you can just see from, you know, the way that big media companies are in big trouble, their advertising is collapsing, and newspapers are going bust and all this sort of stuff. That shows you the power of the new technology that is disrupting them.
I wonder 30 years from now what it'll look like, you know, looking back at this period. What do you imagine?
Well, I mean, we've seen other industries decline. We've seen, you know, what happened to the steel industry. We've seen what happened to the car industry, you know. And what the funny thing is that as a journalist, you know, we're used to writing about other industries declining and saying, well, I mean, when the coal mines were shut down in Britain, you know, well, that was an old fashioned way of doing things, and we needed to find cleaner ways to generate power. So of course, you know, the sort of straightforward market forces argument is nobody owes these guys a living, and it's just hard luck that they happen to be skilled at something that we don't need anymore. And this is the same argument for, you know, blue collar workers being laid off because robots can do their
Luddites.
Jobs. Yeah, well, Luddites. You could take a Luddite view that you know, they should be fighting the technology, but the idea is that this is, you know, no one owes them a living. But the funny thing is, when it comes to journalism, journalists seem unable to apply this argument to themselves, and they go, oh yes, but we're special, and you know, our industry needs, you know, the government should support us, or, you know, democracy will, the world will end if the newspapers go out of business. And I'm not sure that's true. I think actually, you know, these other forms of media are just as democratic, if not more democratic, and we're going to be figuring out new ways to get what we want from media without it all having to be funneled through these sort of you know, very, very selectively controlled mass media mouthpieces.
What do you say to the debate over the political impact of social media and its role in triggering protests and revolutions?
Well, I think we have to be very careful about what we mean by triggering. So, you know, there was a big debate about the Arab Spring. You know, was it a Facebook revolution? And, you know, did Facebook cause the Arab Spring? Of course it didn't. If you look at the cause of the Arab Spring, you've got very high levels of unemployment across the Arab world. You've got despotic, incredibly corrupt regimes. You've got a lack of opportunity for young people. You've got rising fuel and food prices. And all of this leads to, you know, a simmering situation with a lot of discontent. However, you also got a situation where any attempt to speak out against the regime is squished incredibly violently. And so you're unclear how widely these views, if you hold them, are shared by other people. And this is very similar to the situation in Europe at the beginning of the 1500s, where there are lots of people like Martin Luther who think that the Catholic Church is, you know, a very malign influence over society and has got it wrong on some really important things. And so how do you work out how widely your views are shared by others? And that turns out to be something that social media is very good at. Not just because it can spread ideas, but because the way that the ideas spread give you a sense of how widely they are shared. So this is something that modern scholars of media call synchronization of opinion. But just to give you an example, if you are a sympathizer with Martin Luther and you go to the printer in your village and you say, I hear there's a new Luther pamphlet that's come out, have you got it? And the printer says, well, I printed 1,000 copies of it, but they're all gone. Then you know that lots of other people in your village are into this, and, you know, and your views are probably quite widely shared. Similarly, if someone puts up a Facebook page saying, let's clean up Cairo, by which they don't mean let's pick the rubbish off the streets, they mean let's have a protest and, you know, express to the government our dissatisfaction with what's going on, and 80,000 people click like in an hour, then the page gets taken down or whatever. But the point is that you can tell that lots of other people feel the same way that you do about that. And so that's really, I think, what social media lets you do. It allows you to synchronize your opinion with those of other people. And that helps get these revolutions to move faster. Once there's a spark that sets them off, they can sort of spread more quickly because you know, it becomes apparent that that other people agree with this. And so I think the analogy is with an accelerant, which is, you know, something that you use to make a fire burn faster and spread faster. It doesn't start the fire, but once the fire has got that first spark, social media can be an accelerant, a social accelerant, and can allow protests to spread more quickly. And I think we saw that in the Reformation, and we saw it in the Arab Spring as well. So it doesn't actually cause the revolution. I think that's the crucial thing. It just helps it. It helps it spread more quickly.
A long time ago, I was up way too late. This is a real long time ago, maybe in the 90s. And fellow who's considered one of the fathers of the internet, Vince Cerf, was being interviewed on television, and he said something. I was just drifting off to sleep. He said something that actually made me, it woke me up, and it made me sit up and said, what did I just hear him say? What he said was that he felt that the internet, or the invention of it, was as profound as language.
That's
pretty
profound.
A big statement. Yeah. That's a big statement to make, but, you know, in retrospect now, because what are we, 2 or 3 decades from when I heard him make that statement, I don't disagree, because what you're just describing is, prior to the internet, if you wanted to find people with shared interests, you could your options were you could take out an ad in a newspaper, you could nail a flyer to a telephone pole, you could put a sign out in your front yard. You were really limited by geography in how to try to reach other people with your shared interests, regardless of what it was, whether it was politics, quilting, gardening, it doesn't matter. Medical, health information, you were very, very limited by your geography, and the internet and what it's come to be has eliminated all logistics in terms of human communication. I believe that what he said was true, that the internet is as profound as language.
Yeah, I think you can probably make a very good case for that, actually. If you look, I mean, language enables us to communicate with our fellow man, and then successive media technologies make that easier and easier. And we're going to end up with, you know, implants in our heads and, you know, goodness knows what else is coming. But yes, the internet is a big step in the sense that it's the death of distance, as some people call it, that you can find people with common interest to you irrespective of where they are in the world. And that's a wonderful thing. So yes, I think that's an amazingly profound shift.
Right, because like that opportunity, it actually didn't exist prior. Like it didn't exist.
Well, it sort of did. I mean, there were precursors to it. Obviously, they were not as cheap and easy to use and fast. But if you look at, say, the genesis of scientific journals. So what scientific journals were, they were a way to extend the spirit of the coffeehouse discussion across Europe, you know, by and large, so that people across Europe could contribute to a discussion, and you would send stuff into a journal and it would be printed and then sent out to all of the subscribers. And the idea was to sort of have a virtual distributed coffeehouse. And this has led to, you know, progress in science and the sort of modern emergence of scientific journals. But it was very much being part of a distributed correspondence network was the idea. So in that particular case, and of course, it's a very specific case of scientists who had a common interest, and they believed that the pursuit of science was more important than, you know, it should transcend national boundaries. And it's very interesting. You see cooperation between scientists, even when their countries are at war, in that period of history. So that was a specific example. Now, obviously, if you were interested in, you know, something much more esoteric, then there was not going to be a network of journals to cover that. And of course, the internet extends this so that no matter what you're interested in, you can find other people who have that interest. But there are precursors to this in history, where you have these attempts to link up with people who have common interests with you. So it's not entirely unprecedented, but it's just on a scale that we haven't been able to do before.
You're right. I'm Rabia Yeaman with The Digital Divide, and I am here today with Tom Standage. He's live in our studio. He is the author of many books, his most recent, Writing on the Wall, Social Media, the First 2,000 Years, and that's published by Bloomsbury?
Yep.
There you go. You can look that up. Do you believe that governments have the power and the ability to deny social media to its citizens? I mean, is it actually possible, or is there always a way to get the word out?
It's always possible to get around them. I mean, the most sophisticated censor of the internet in the world at the moment is China, and it's really not that hard to get around the Great Firewall. The point is that it's fiddly enough that most people aren't going to bother. And, you know, most people in China don't want to spend all day looking for pictures of Tiananmen Square on the internet. So the interesting question is whether the Chinese ability to sort of keep the lid on social and political dissent on social media is sustainable. So they have a very large army of people who look out for particular, you know, unacceptable things. And the particular thing, I mean, they don't actually mind criticism of the government, say, surprisingly, on social media in China. What they are particularly worried about is online activism turning into real-world offline activism. So actually,
like a real movement,
exactly,
of physical people.
So even if you say, let's have a march, let's meet, you know, in this place, and it's to support the government, they still won't allow it. What they're really terrified of is that the internet will be used to mobilize people in the world.
And there's so many people, if they were to get, even a fraction of them were to get mobilized,
exactly,
they would have like some serious problems.
So that's what they really come down on like a ton of bricks. Any attempt to use the internet as a platform to mobilize people, and whether it's, you know, for or against the government. So at the moment, they seem to be keeping the lid on that. But the question is whether that's sustainable and how that will play out. And that will be, you know, that's one of the most interesting things that's happening about the politics of the internet now, because we've seen attempts to do this elsewhere not succeed. And, you know, famously, the Egyptian government turned off the internet because it was worried that it was being used in this way. And that actually made things worse, because when the internet was turned off, everyone just went out onto the streets. And, you know, I was speaking to one of the organizers of those protests, and he was saying that that was when they knew the government was scared. They realized that if the government was so scared of the internet that they turned it off, that meant that it had real power. So I think, you know, China is the real test case in all of this.
Is it fair to say that throughout history, kings and dictators have been attempting to suppress information from reaching the masses?
Yes, and they've always wanted to have their sort of their view of things, you know, prevail. And so that's a fairly sort of standard desire to control the information environment. And you know, the whole thing about peer-to-peer social media is that it's very difficult to control. And when you start to have technologies that can amplify that, like printing presses or the internet, there are always attempts to control them. We see this, you know, attempts to decide who gets access to printing presses starting in the 1500s. And they're very similar to arguments about access to the internet today. And so you get guilds of printers saying to the government, why don't you give us a monopoly on printing and we'll make sure that nobody prints anything that you don't like. And this is sort of very similar to the way telcos today say, you know, let us decide what is and is not appropriate here. And then by an amazing coincidence, this may align with their own, you know, business interests. Let's slow down video from people other than ourselves so that everyone has to subscribe to our video service or whatever. I mean, those sorts of arguments are very similar to the sorts of things the Stationers' Company of England was saying in the 1580s.
Just trying to satisfy those shareholders.
Yep.
So it sounds like one way, because I'm always, I don't know about you, you're not a citizen of the United States.
Nope.
So your perspective, of course, and the information that you have is really radically different than people who live here. And I am, of course, citizen and always have been, but I am still flummoxed by our overall complacency as a society, and we have what I consider to be some pretty oppressive and crazy policies. Like right now, you know, as you are probably well aware, we have a debate about whether everybody is entitled to health care or not, which is a crazy, crazy debate. We have people who want to take it away and then saying, you know, well, we'll figure out something even better after we take it away. And so that sounds crazy to me. However, unlike other countries who would be outraged, and I think out in the streets, Spain, about something, you know, having their right to health care, take, you know, people trying to take that away from them. So do you, but I mean, they have social media too. So, you know, I want to say, well, if a country has social media and they have, and the society and the populace, unlike Egypt, you know, have the right to, if they have the freedom to express themselves and their unhappiness with the system, that the government in general is like, hey, that's fine. You can complain all you want as long as you don't actually do something about it.
So this is the sort of safety valve theory. And this is very much, I think, what the Chinese are banking on. What social media?
But is our government banking on it too?
No, I don't think it is. No, but I think you can very clearly see this in China, that social media gives people the illusion of you know, the right to discuss things, and it looks sort of more democratic. But actually, the government's not going to do anything different. And as long as you don't say anything too outrageous, they'll let you do it. So it gives you this sort of safety valve. And to some extent, it does make, you know, mid-level officials more accountable. And, you know, you can sort of call them out for wearing fancy watches and having too many cars and say, well, there's something funny going on there. But as long as you don't criticize people at the top of the regime, then you'll be fine. So where does this correspond to the US? I mean, I think...
I don't see it being that different, especially with the recent revelations of the NSA.
Right, but I don't think the government is saying we're going to do all these terrible things, but because everyone has social media, we're going to sort of it'll be fine. These are all separate debates. I think the social media is not magic. It's not a panacea. Actually, it turns out that voting isn't either. I mean, democracy isn't. I mean, we very often assume that when you have an election, you've got democracy and everything's fine. If you look at just the way everything fell apart in Egypt, you have to have elections in democracy, but then you have to have institutions that implement the stuff that the people have asked for. Mm-hmm. And you need to have both of those things. And, you know, the problem that the US has at the moment is that the institutions are not working properly. You have elections, but then you have this problem with actually getting anything to happen. And this isn't right. just the US. To be honest, democracy is on the ropes in many countries. It doesn't seem to be giving people what they want, or it doesn't seem to be able to fix the problems. Across Europe, we've had technocratic governments put in, which is arguably quite undemocratic, in order to try and fix the financial problems that the European countries have, because no one's ever going to vote for those solutions because they're just too painful and too horrible. So right. I think there's a broader question about democracy. And this is, of course, great for the Chinese because they can go, well, democracy doesn't really work. Let's keep with the system we have. So I think all of these things are symptoms of a bigger problem, which is that democracy needs a sort of reboot. And we need to figure out how to make it work so it can solve the sorts of problems we have here. I mean, in the US, you have this, you know, in California, say, you have the tendency that everyone will vote for stuff that involves more spending, but no one ever wants to vote for higher taxes. And you pretty much have that problem in Europe as well, that people vote for earlier retirement ages, higher pensions. And then when the bill comes along, they say, well, can't you tax the rich? And the trouble is there aren't enough rich people and they don't have enough money. So you can't just do everything by taxing them. And so you have this problem that
we can.
You can?
Well, we probably could here in this country. Well, because the divide between
is so big.
Incomes
yeah,
is
exactly.
so huge.
But, you know, raising taxes is you know, as you'll have noticed, something that's quite difficult to get the politicians
Indeed.
To do. Yeah. So instead you end up with this, well, we definitely want more spending, but we just don't want any more taxes. And you can't go on doing that forever, especially if you default on your debts. So, yeah, it's tricky.
Does that come from just... Everybody, I know it's a pretty big statement to make, but I mean, does that just come from, is that symptomatic of our modern world and a feeling of overall entitlement to luxuries that we've become accustomed to that just aren't realistic or practical in a consumer-based economy?
Well, I think healthcare isn't a luxury. I think it's, you know, I think the fact that the richest country in the world doesn't have a medical safety net for its poorest people is an outrage. And I think, you know, the fact that Obamacare, you know, addresses that to a great extent is resolving frankly, an enormous anomaly. I mean, it does look very odd indeed from a European perspective. I mean, the big problem, of course, is that healthcare in the US is more expensive than anywhere else and produces worse outcomes.
Right.
So that's the real question. How can you get a healthcare system that delivers the goods and isn't so expensive, that it isn't 20% of the economy? So that's right. that's really a separate issue. But I think the social justice question of you know, should you have universal healthcare? Yes, you should in a modern civilized country. And you can do it without breaking the bank. I mean, look at the Nordic countries. They seem to be very good at this stuff. So there are countries that are doing a good job of delivering social services.
They have different priorities. Those other countries have Sweden different yep. different priorities. They have different values. What they value in their countries as a society are actually just completely different than what our country here in the US.
Well, they have a different value. They have a different social contract. It's true, and so right. you have to then ask, well, is it does that mean the social contract in America has to change? You know, it's a very good question because America benefits from the very individualist nature of its social contract because you get more entrepreneurism and more innovation here than you do anywhere else. So how do you preserve that without undermining, you know, the benefits of that if you change the social contract so that you have a more collectivist approach? You know, how do you maintain those benefits? So these are all very, very deep and difficult questions. And all of the arguments that we see around tax and around healthcare and so on are just symptoms of this much deeper underlying problem.
So coming back to our topic, do you think that social media has the ability to affect the outcome of these questions?
No, I just think it makes it easier for more people to discuss them. But I don't think it's a solution. It's not a medicine.
You think it can rally people and voters and influence them to make to influence their representatives, which.
It can do, but you need to have so
that's possible.
It can, but you need to have there needs to actually be an underlying consensus to rally people around. So a very nice example of this is what happened with Thomas Paine and Common Sense. So it turned out that a majority of the American colonists were in favour of independence from Britain. They just didn't realise it. And his pamphlet made the case so brilliantly, and people showed it to their friends and said, isn't this great? And they just, you know, it was such a beautiful outlining of the argument. And not everyone agreed with it, but, and you know, there was a majority of people who agreed with it, and ultimately that view prevailed. So what that was able to do was rally people around that, and then, you know, there was a sort of clear, okay, we'll have a war, we'll win, and we'll be independent. If you look at what happened in the French Revolution, there was agreement that the king had to go, and the old way of doing things where the nobles didn't have to pay tax and all this kind of stuff was completely unfair. So they had a revolution and they got rid of all that, but they couldn't agree what to replace it with. And the result was chaos. And so and they had a social media environment as well, but it was a very toxic one where people were using the media to call for their opponents to be guillotined. So it's a very different situation from America, which had a social media environment because there was an underlying consensus which social media could reveal. And in France, there wasn't. So
and when you call for someone to be guillotined on Facebook, they aren't actually guillotined.
No, they're not, but they actually were in France.
They might be socially, their social reputation might be.
Right, well, yes, exactly. But no, their factions in France, you know, they essentially, there wasn't an agreement about what to replace the government with. There was only an agreement to get rid of the old one. So I think you could only, if it turned out there was a great, you know, if someone came up with a great plan, then you could use social media to rally people around that plan. And what we actually need is people to come up with plans. Do you see what I mean? So social media is great for rallying people around a cause, but it's not going to create the cause. It's not going to create the manifesto.
Right. You still have to have a plan.
Exactly. So it is a mouthpiece, but it's a broadcasting or a distribution medium. But you still need the actual content to put into it. And so that's the hard bit. You know, you need the political ideas, the new thinking.
You're the web publisher for a website. You know the horrors of what is out there floating around on the internet. Privacy, malware, crazy malware situation is off the charts out on the internet. It's nuts. And then there's concerns about privacy and selling information.
Yep.
Plus there's the spying. So like personally, where are you as a professional on the privacy issue?
So within our business, we have the New York Times test, which is, you know, you shouldn't ever put anything in an email on the internet that you would be unhappy to see on the front page of the New York Times. So you just have to assume it's all private. And so I do. And I like Twitter because it is, you know, the default is everything is public on Twitter. I think the problem is not so much privacy as when the goalposts are moved. So if it's when you use a system that says, oh, this is all private, and then a few months later, I'm looking at you, Facebook, they say, well, actually, we've changed our minds. And those things that used to be the private, we're going to make some of them public, or we're going to allow some people to see them. And there's this kind of slow ratchet effect where they kind of open up more and more stuff. And I think what actually irritates people is this changing of the rules all the time. And there are social networks that are private, and there are some that are public. So I think it's really about whether companies and networks and organizations stick to what they originally said they were going to do or not, and whether we can all be bothered to hold them to account on that and see, you know, read the rules and so on. So I think that's really the problem, that there isn't enough that the rules keep getting moved around. And there are, you know, you can have private threads on Facebook, but you just can't be sure that they're still going to be private in a few years' time. So I think that's ultimately the problem here. And so it's really a matter of sort of corporate reputation. Can Facebook, can it actually maintain the trust of its users if it keeps pulling this same stunt? And I think that's quite an interesting long-term challenge for them, because clearly what's in the interests of their readers and users is not necessarily what's in their own commercial interests. And so they have this sort of inherent conflict, which other social networks don't seem to have to the same extent. And then, to some extent, Google does too. But, that's a slightly different situation. But I think that's what concerns me, that we're sort of, we want to play by the rules, but the people who set the rules keep changing them.
Do you think that Google will get too big for itself?
some people think it already has. So you know, there are certain, I mean, with any company that big, there are going to be the things that you criticize about it. And there's a big fuss about, you know, the extent to which it can use personal information that you supply to create sort of marketing, to create advertising that it shows to your friends. And, you know, that's something they haven't done before, but it's actually something Facebook's been doing for a while.
Right.
And we kind of, you know, roll our eyes when Facebook does it. So, you know, do we hold Google to a higher standard? I don't know. But it's that sort of thing where when they're going to change the rules, and Google has done this too, when they merge together all their sites, you know, and they start sharing your stuff you post on Google Plus, you know, appears on YouTube or whatever. Are they doing that in a way that where people trust them? And do they do it in a way that engenders trust? Or do they do it in a way that people think is playing fast and loose? And, you know, there are a lot of people who do think that they haven't been open and reasonable about this. So I think that's very much a debate worth having. And, you know, of course, we can discuss all this. And we saw things like when Instagram changed its terms of service and everyone just went nuts. And there was, you know, there really was a sort of outcry, and they had to row back on it. So I think it's great that social media gives us this ability to respond when things like that happen, whether it's on the internet or elsewhere.
So your book and the content in your book, reading it, it has that feeling of, well, I had this conversation in a coffee shop with a guy and we made a deal, and I told him I would prove my point. And that your book kind of, it proves a point about social media and history. So is that why you wrote the book?
Well, sort of. Yeah, I do think a lot of what is said about social media and new technologies in general would benefit from a sort of dose of historical perspective. And so when people say, oh, you know, there's never been anything like this before, you know, I'm that just, you know, makes me.
And you were
say,
like, yes, there is. And I'm going to write a book to prove it.
Exactly. But it's also but it's particularly when it's not just this sort of the similarities of the actual underlying technology. It's actually that the idea that new technologies are sort of changing human nature, and that's just wrong. And people have made these claims about new technologies a lot,
especially if it makes them more civil and communicative.
Well, I'm not sure it's certainly making them easier to communicate, but I'm not sure it actually changes our human nature to make us more civil. But what we have is new technologies pushing the same old buttons in our heads. And so you know, when people complain that video games are evil, I just say, well, this is what people said about novels, and this is what people said about comic books. And when people say, oh, well, social media is a waste of time, I say, well, this is what people said about coffee houses.
Right.
So I think there's an enormous amount that we can learn from the past, that this assumption that everything we're living through is totally unprecedented and that we have no sort of way of figuring out how we should deal with it is very often not true. And there are very often very useful things that have happened in the past that can help us and give us a perspective. And not only that, not only does the past help us reevaluate what's going on now, but our experience of what we're doing now can help us understand the past better. We can sort of understand how, the advent of the telegraph had its amazing impact on the Victorians. And, you know, they really felt the world was shrinking, and it must have been actually much more mind-blowing for them than the internet was for us. So I think we can understand the past better, and we can also understand the present better by connecting, by seeing aspects of the past in the present and the present in the past. And that's what I do in all my books. And in this particular case, I'm doing it with the history of media. But I think it's a broader lesson that we could all benefit from a dose of history every now and then.
So you're a history buff.
Yeah. I'm not a historian by training. You know, I'm actually an engineer by training. But I just think historical perspective, you can't have too much of it.
I love it. Tom Standage, thank you so much for joining us on The Digital Divide today.
Thank you.
All right. And you are listening to The Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Rabia Yeaman. Thanks so much for tuning in. And, of course, you can hear us at 90.7 FM Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM in Philomath and Corvallis, and translator IDs at K220-HR in Hood River and K282-BH in Philomath. You can contact us, our front desk, at 503-231-8032 and send mail to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And be sure and tune in every second Friday of the month for the Digital Divide, where we cover topics having to do with science, technology, metaphysics, and the environment. You can go to kboo.fm and get archives of this program. And while you're there, become a supporting member of your non-corporate, non-commercial community radio station, KBOO Portland. Thanks for tuning in.
Tune in every Friday at 3 p.m. for Roots of Rock and Roll. Dale Farr and Steve Bricker play rare and vintage records from rhythm and blues, jump blues, rockabilly, and doo-wop, from the birth of rock and roll, the 50s and early 60s. Roots of Rock and Roll, only on KBOO Portland.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, November 8th. I'm Kristen Yount. Portland Business Journal writer Wendy Coverwell reported that on Wednesday, legal counsel from the Right to Dream 2 camp announced to back off a legal suit against the city. This action in good faith may help smooth things out as camp leaders move forward with plans to move the managed tent city to a place called Lot 7 under the Broadway Bridge near the City Bucket, adjacent to the Pearl District. The decision of Right to Dream 2, or R2D2, took the fight out of the courts surprised the Neighborhood Association, investors, and Pearl developers who have been working in concert to suppress the move. These interested parties, the so-called Pearl Group, have pledged dollars and said they would furnish another spot with buses for camp residents to use. These offers are to coax R2D2 to find someone else's backyard. The Portland Mercury reported that Mayor Charlie Hales initially endorsed the idea until a major donor came forward with issues with the move. Four United States oil traders plan to sue Shell Oil and British Petroleum for price fixing. The suit implicates other companies like Morgan Stanley, the Vital Group, and Trafigura in sketchy dealings in trading Brent crude oil. Brent crude oil is defined as a light, sweet crude oil. Those traits are favorable for refining. Brent crude comes from the North Sea, and particulars of that type of crude make it easy for insiders to influence the market in their favor. Price fixing is punishable with very high fines. A Canadian province banned hydraulic fracturing method of extracting natural gas from the earth for the time being. The natural resource manager for Newfoundland and Labrador told the House of the Assembly that the provincial government would not be accepting any proposals for on- or offshore drilling that employ fracking. This comes after the Shoal Point Energy Group and their partners Black Spruce Exploration put in a bid to explore the Green Point Shale Formation for gas near the unspoiled Gros Morne National Park. The park is in a UNESCO Natural Heritage Site. The decision comes at a time when those from the neighboring province of New Brunswick are preparing for a sacred fire blockade beginning this weekend. The group of First Nation activists has faced violence from the Mounted Canadian Police in recent actions. SWN Resources, a Texas company, won permits to do seismic testing that would affect sacred lands protected by treaties. As a result, members of the groups, the Mi'kmaq Warrior Society, the Elspetog First Nation, and others will light a sacred fire to block the project from moving forward. So far, they have found and gathered the testing wires that lay by the side of the road and rendered them useless. That's it for the news today at noon. Please tune in every weekday at 5 p.m. for the latest in local, national, and international news brought to you.